This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Tara Gross. The protests at the Democratic National Convention yesterday focused on the theme of police corruption and brutality, with a staged sit-in at the Los Angeles Police Department's Rampart Station House, a division involved in the LAPD's worst corruption scandal in a decade. As the group moved toward the convention site, skirmishes broke out, with police beating some of the demonstrators with batons. The local Los Angeles chapter of the ACLU announced yesterday it would file a civil suit in federal court accusing the LAPD of harassing journalists, including one case of firing rubber bullets at a freelance photographer. The protests at the conventions in Los Angeles and Philadelphia have raised questions about police response to political activism and the public's level of tolerance for protest and civil disobedience. Thomas Ginsburg and Monica Yant Kinney covered the protests during the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia for the Philadelphia Inquirer. The story of the protesters is still unfolding. So far, one lawsuit alleging abuse has been filed against the Philadelphia police, but legal organizations representing the demonstrators are considering more. As of Tuesday, all of the protesters arrested in Philadelphia were out of jail. Trials are set to begin in September. Monica Yant Kinney recaps what happened in Philadelphia during the Republican convention 2 weeks ago.
The bulk of the arrests, and I think the last city count was at about 391. It could go a little bit higher. I think there were a quartet of people who were arrested after that final count. Now, the protesters have given much larger numbers. The bulk of the arrests took place for events surrounding the Tuesday of the convention. Planned protests to block streets, to block traffic during rush hour that wound up in many cases, some cases being violent. There were incidents of vandalism. Car windows were smashed. Tires were slashed. Spray painted. I know a city official who had the word fascist spray painted on her car. There was an incident in which a lot of the policing was done by cops on bikes. And in fact, at one incident, some bike cops were essentially allegedly attacked by protesters who had taken their bikes, and the police commissioner was roughed up in one incident. And while there were a handful of folks who were given felony charges, the bulk were misdemeanor charges, things like obstructing a highway, obstructing justice. Possession of an instrument of crime was an interesting charge that got a lot of attention here. The theory in Philadelphia was that the so-called instruments of crime were Nextel cell phones, walkie-talkies, and Palm Pilots, and that a lot of this work that was being coordinated on the streets was being done with, you know, these little electronic handheld devices, and those were the so-called instruments of crime. You know, protester after protester would decry that, you know, they were picked up simply walking down the street talking on a telephone. Now, you know, we'll have to see what happens when these cases actually go to trial, if that was indeed the situation. There was a raid of a warehouse in West Philadelphia where puppet-making materials were being stored, where groups of protesters had been putting together large puppets, political puppets, and signs for quite some time. And it turned into about a six-hour standoff of sorts. I actually was there all day while the police waited for their search warrant to arrive. A group of protesters calling themselves the Haverford 70, because there were 70 of them and they were on Haverford Avenue, were, you know, holding out banners, unfurling banners from inside saying "Free the Haverford 70." They allege that they were kept inside this warehouse against their will. The police say, "Well, no, actually, they could have left at any time, but we could not go in until we had this search warrant." Those folks were then trotted out one by one, cuffed, taken on a bus, taken away while this raid of that facility took place. And Tom, you want to talk a little bit about what they found inside there? Or?
I understand they found coffee cans full of kerosene attached to chains with rags soaked, which they believe were to be used in some sort of weapon. There does also happen to be a new trend in something called fire twirling, where you do these as some kind of performance art, and it is. It's popular among this particular crowd of people who were here. So, you know, who knows what this stuff was used for. There was PVC piping, which is a type of construction piping, which can be used to hold up a sign in a protest, or can also be used to stick your hand into and chain you to somebody else to form a blockade. So what the stuff was actually going to be used for, we don't know. The police say it was going to be used to obstruct traffic, which is a violation of law, and the protesters adamantly insist it was for artwork for puppets. And the case may or may not hinge on what they were going to do with it. I don't know. Maybe the fact that it was there, and the fact that the police surrounded this place for hours, and in fact were not letting people out, even though they said they were. I talked to some people by phone inside while this was going on, and they said they tried to get out, and police wouldn't let them. Yeah, I think a lot of the circumstances around that event will probably form as much of the legal case as what they found.
And then what you had happen after, whether it was for folks arrested in the middle of a protest or those folks who were inside, the notion was jail solidarity. We will not say who we are. We will not allow ourselves to be separated. We will not allow them to use one of us against another in terms of, you know, hey, you can get out of jail early if you rat on this other person. Mm-hmm. So what you had for a time is hundreds of Jane and John Doe's. Sometimes they would add, you know, a nickname on the end, Jane Doe Sprinkle or Jane, you know, Sunshine. And as a means of slowing down the process, keeping the authorities from knowing who they were. Over time, some of those folks, you know, chafed under the unpleasantries of being in jail. A lot of them, you know, all last week we had, you know, a dozen or so a day eventually giving up their names so they could get their bail reduced, so they could get out of jail. It wasn't a place they really wanted to be, and in turn they launched a brand new protest against jail conditions in Philadelphia and talked a lot about how they were treated inside.
I'd like to talk about some of the, if not leaders, some of the leading personalities in the protest, at least in Philadelphia, some of the people who you as reporters took more seriously. Monica, you profiled John Sellers, and he's nationally known as a civil disobedience activist among those circles. Could you give us some background on him?
Yeah, John Sellers, actually, he came to light almost by accident in Philadelphia. He by all accounts, was here to observe more than anything. Sellers is the head of the Ruckus Society, which is a San Francisco, Berkeley-based organization that has emerged in the last 5 years as a leading educator for folks wanting to learn civil disobedience. They hold clinics and training sessions around the country for different kinds of groups. And by and large, they are quite clear. They are nonviolent civil disobedience. And they teach the methods. They teach how to do it safely. Sellers is a native of the Philadelphia suburbs, and he was here, at least by his and his family's accounts, to observe and was going to be headed to the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles. I actually happened to see Sellers get arrested. He was walking down the street and actually accompanied by a couple of reporters when all of a sudden, you know, he's surrounded by police officers that include one of the deputy commissioners of the Philadelphia Department. By accounts of the witnesses, he was talking to the folks with him, had perhaps been on his cell phone prior, and again was in possession of a cell phone and a Palm Pilot on him. And he was taken in and was, you know, the DA and the police department's response was that he was this ringleader. He was orchestrating this because he was this nationally known figure who's been on the front page of the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times. And the sense was that he was a pretty good example of the kind of police targeting that was going on here. He was familiar. His face was well known. And to talk to some of the lawyers involved in representing the protesters, he may have indeed been picked up, at least their count is, he was picked up as sort of a favor to the feds, that maybe if you could keep this guy in custody, he wouldn't wind up in Los Angeles and could somehow be kept away from those events. His family, of course, said that is not the case. That was not why he was here. And he was one of the folks held on $1 million bail, all misdemeanors, no clear sign of what it was he had been doing or had done previously to justify the arrest. When it came down, he gave his name. He participated. He was not a Jane or John Doe. And his bail was reduced drastically, and he was let out. And, you know, he has maintained all along that this was an absolutely false arrest just for the sake of getting him off the streets and keeping him away.
What were his actual alleged offenses?
Much of the same as a lot of the other folks, obstructing highway, obstructing justice, that possession of instrument of crime. There was some talk that he had been spotted chaining himself or chaining someone else to a trash can and throwing trash into the street. There was very little coming out of the DA's office about exactly where or when that happened. Clearly, it wasn't that particular day. I saw the guy. There was no trash anywhere near him when they took him in, and he was not resisting in any way, shape, or form. And, you know, to talk to people who know him and to check his record, he had been arrested on previous occasions, but he's never been violent, and that's not his cause at all. I mean, he's been an environmental activist. He's been a peaceful protester for most of his life, and everyone was pretty startled by the things that they were saying about him.
Tom, I thought it was interesting that you wrote in one article about the demonstrators that they may look disorganized, and this might also be true of Los Angeles, but at least in Philadelphia, they actually aren't disorganized, and they are, in fact, quite sophisticated in their use of technology and strategy. Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, this is interesting, too, and this is something I think the police do understand, actually. They may not understand the goals, but I think they understand somewhat how it works, which is interesting then when they come out and call people a leader. They do have a structure where they don't like anyone to be identified as a leader, both for tactical and political philosophical reasons. They don't like leaders, especially the anarchist streak among some of them. And for tactical reasons, if you have a leader and that leader is arrested, then you're leaderless, and you try to avoid that. The way they organize protests here, and I just presume the way they are being done in Los Angeles is a structure that is based on affinity groups, where you have small groups of people who get together and decide among themselves voluntarily what action they want to take, and are then coordinated through people who have either mapped out the city or mapped out certain areas with a strategy towards either disrupting a street, closing a building, targeting a certain meeting, whatever it might be. And it's all very diffuse. The decision-making is very diffuse. So you have one group that has mapped out, say, the building here, and they know that there's a back door, and there's an alley over here, and there's a street, and there's a police substation down the block. And they then go to the affinity group, and they present that information to the affinity group, and they say, here's an opportunity for you. And the group then decides what to do. In some cases, the group then goes out to do this activity, and they find that the police have surrounded the building. So they quickly call up those people on their cell phones, their Nextels, which is a particular kind of cell phone that can double as a walkie-talkie. And you say, well, gee, this place is blocked. What else do you got? And they say, well, it looks like there's another place over there. So then they hang up. They say, well, should we go do it? Okay, let's go do it. So it's very diffuse, decentralized decision-making. It's sophisticated in that it always works with electronic communication, it seems to anyway, and it's sophisticated and tactically, they can arrest a lot of people, and yet these protests can continue with whoever's left on the street.
They also divided their groups into different groups, a tactical group, right, and a medical group.
There are a lot of different kinds of support, medical, legal, technical. One of them that they had here was tactical support, people who were deployed around to different areas of the city that they had previously mapped out, and they had phones, and they were not taking part in protests. They were just telling people that this area is clear. Here, there's a group coming here. There's a group going there. Interestingly enough, the police realized this enough. In fact, they realized this in Seattle, that if they target people who are on the phones, they can hamper the protest somewhat. They can certainly hamper the coordination, and that seems to have what happened here. By Wednesday morning, the second day of the bad protests here, a lot of people were saying they couldn't reach their tactical people by telephone, and they were not answering their phones. It appeared that the police had kind of eaten out the core of some of their coordination, so that left them still doing their activities, their actions, but much less coordinated and a little frustrated. So to that degree, they're sophisticated, and I think police are learning how to target them, and protesters, in turn, very likely, will learn how to get around it.
My guests are Philadelphia Inquirer reporters Tom Ginsburg and Monica Yant Kinney. They covered the protests during the Republican National Convention here in Philadelphia and are following the story of the lawsuit that has grown out of the demonstrations. Let's take a break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Philadelphia Inquirer reporters Monica Yant Kinney and Tom Ginsburg. They covered the protest beat during the Republican National Convention earlier this month and also are covering its fallout. Let's pick up the story since the end of the Republican convention in Philadelphia. Can you give us a rundown on the lawsuits that have been filed against the city since then?
So far, there has been one lawsuit. There had initially been talk and promises and threats of more, and what they would exactly be over varied from unlawful search and seizure to arrest without probable cause and search warrants. The one lawsuit they've managed to put together so far is over the unlawful search and seizure of protest medics, people who were activists who had been outfitted as medics and were prowling the streets, basically in the same pattern that the protesters were, but the medics were there as observers, as medics only, were not supposed to take part in any protests. At roughly the same time, on the same day, on Tuesday, the second day, or actually the third day, the protest, the biggest protest, at about the same time in the day, several groups of these medics seem to have been targeted at the same time. At least that's their allegation. They were surrounded by groups of bicycle cops or others. They were forced to put their hands on walls. Their stuff was gone through. In some cases, their bandages were thrown away in the garbage right in front of them. In some cases, they say their water was poured out on the street. They were told to pour it out. In one case, a guy was told to drink his own water to prove that it was water. Another case, somebody said that the officer poured the water over his head. Lots of little harassment. No, none of these people were arrested. And this was a pretty clear, at least easily argued case. And this appears to be the reason why the lawyers chose to mount this one first.
The ACLU, though, has filed in federal court on behalf of the main protest organizers in Los Angeles, accusing the LAPD of infringing on free speech by harassing and intimidating peaceful protesters. Does the ACLU cite examples from the Philadelphia police action in their suit?
That I don't know. There have been some suggestions that the Los Angeles police did this preemptively after the police raided the warehouse here. I have not seen any proof of that. And certainly the Los Angeles police don't seem to need a lot of pointers from Philadelphia police when it comes to dealing with crowds. I think that they certainly have had experience. That is not to say that they don't watch each other. There was a contingent of Los Angeles police in Philadelphia observing events here. To what extent they were involved in arrests or other things, we don't know. Philadelphia police were in Washington and D.C. in April to study things there, as both L.A. and Philly police were in Seattle last year studying things there. They cooperate with each other. In addition to that, there was a multi-agency task force that included federal officials that was in operation here through the whole convention, and they shared a lot of information. You know, where does an idea come from to do things? I don't know. But
it has been interesting to note that even in the first few instances of protest police conflict in Los Angeles, that there have been clear differences in their approach. I mean, even Philadelphia Police Commissioner John Timoney has made a couple swiping remarks about the difference in apparel and the riot gear that L.A. police have chosen to use and the rubber bullets, which Timoney famously said, you know, I'm from Ireland, we don't use rubber bullets. And he made, you know, Philadelphia was quite clear in saying we won't do tear gas, we won't do rubber bullets. And they are taking some clear steps to distance themselves from what is happening or not happening in Los Angeles.
Monica Yant Kinney and Tom Ginsburg reported on the protests during the Republican National Convention and are covering the legal aftermath for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll hear more in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our conversation with Philadelphia Inquirer reporters Monica Yant Kinney and Tom Ginsberg. They covered the protest during the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia earlier this month and have been reporting on the legal fallout. Almost 400 protesters were arrested. The last of the demonstrators were released from jail on Tuesday. Some critics have accused the city of holding protesters in jail for an unreasonably long time during their processing in an effort to keep them off the streets. I asked Monica Yant Kinney about the validity of that claim.
Well, I think to a large extent the police have acknowledged that they did have a strategy to keep certain people off the streets. I mean, in a story that we wrote, they said, you know, they acknowledged that they were targeting people they believed to be leaders, ringleaders, they called them, organizers. Whether those people were indeed leaders or not, they had surveillance, they had intelligence that said these folks were, you know, directly involved in the planning of some of these activities. But what's interesting about the length of time in detainment is that, you know, you have a lot of different stories about why it took so long. I mean, on one hand, you have police saying what we've said all along is we're not going to make any special arrangements for these folks. We're not going to somehow expedite a system for a bunch of potentially out-of-town protesters that give them better treatment than your garden variety Philadelphia criminal would get. And on the other hand, they were so overwhelmed by the number of people coming into the system that even the typical structure of how you move someone from one location to the next to get them to arraignment is going to be slowed down. And then you have the matter of people who just flatly refuse to give their names or cooperate in any way. And that's going to slow down any system. At one point, when some of the bail hearings were going on, folks were petitioning to have their bail reduced. And a lawyer representing a group of Jane and John Doe's made an appeal. You know, these folks are in here for ridiculously high bails, Judge, and we want to get them brought down. And she said, well, let me get this straight. They haven't given their names. They've given no information. And you want me to reduce their bail. And I don't know who they are or where they're from. She said, you know, they can pay the bail that they've got now, which a lot of people did, and they actually got out as Jane and John Doe's. But I'm not going to cut them any slack if we don't know who they are. They're a complete flight risk. And we're not going to – they just – over and over again, we're not going to make special accommodations for folks just because they were brought in on, you know, on charges that may very well get thrown out of court once their cases move through the system. I mean, clearly by virtue of – agreeing to drop a lot of these bails, the DA's office acknowledged that $1 million for misdemeanor charges was exorbitant. And each one of those hearings where the DA came in saying, all right, we'll take it down to $200,000 or so, was an admission that these are probably going to be kicked out once things move along in the system.
What was the justification, though, for the high bails? Was there a consensus among the sources you have in the legal community that is not only out of line, but unconstitutional?
Oh, the consensus was everyone was fairly shocked. I mean, defense attorneys all over town and legal experts said you have people accused of felonies, serious, heinous crimes that don't see bails quite that high. And everyone was sort of scratching their head. And to that end, I'm not sure that we ever heard from the DA's office the specifics beyond this person was an organizer and a ringleader, a master of mayhem, someone who was the force behind violence that erupted, and therefore that's why we're sticking these charges. I mean, quietly, a week later, when each of these bail reduction hearings that were held came into place, someone from the DA's office walked in and told the judge in the case, sure, I recommend reducing it to, you know, from $1 million to $200,000 without much explanation. The judge would in turn say, I'm taking it down even further. This is, you know, these are misdemeanor charges. You don't need to hear much explanation beyond the fact that within the span of 5 or 6 days, the DA was, after the convention was gone, the DA was willing to say these bails were too high. Now, whether that issue comes out when those that, you know, those cases that go to trial, they may not have much of a case at all. But the idea being if the police seem to think if you could keep somebody behind bars and keep them there long enough, you could prevent any more violence or eruptions to happen here.
Could you describe the conditions under which protesters, many of them were held here in the city while awaiting bail hearings and arraignments, since that is under scrutiny now?
Well, you have two different stories. You have the descriptions that the protesters give, and you have the descriptions that the police and the city gives. And to some extent, you have a third, which is some of the neutral observations of attorneys who went in. They didn't let folks like Tom and I go in and have the run of the place. But on the protester side, you had some pretty over-the-top accusations about folks being hog-tied, folks being dragged naked against their will through, you know, through hallways. At one point, someone said they were dragged through a trough of urine and feces, and folks being essentially chained to a chained to the cell for the purpose of trying to get their fingerprint or take a picture. They complained about everything from the food offerings. There were quite a few vegetarians and vegans in particular who didn't take well to the white bread and cheese sandwiches, which are the fare when you're in jail in Philadelphia, nor did a lot of the suburban or college age, maybe first timers in jail, understand that you have to go to the bathroom in front of your fellow inmates. There were a lot of indignities that seemed to be the focus of their anger and frustration that perhaps didn't cross over into the line of brutality or mistreatment. On the other hand, you didn't hear the police saying that this was all true. They said, well, yeah, we feed them cheese sandwiches. That's the standard fare. And when someone practices noncompliance and they take off their clothes and they refuse to be physically moved, we do have to drag them. That's how we get people moving around. That's a police tactic. The ACLU did have attorneys that were in at several points during the custody, and for the most part, we did not hear that coming. They were not echoing the loud, angry condemnations that were coming from the protesters. They said they just didn't see the extremities. Whether or not, I mean, folks were transported between a couple different facilities, and it's entirely possible that some of these things did take place, but without physically being inside, it just seemed that every day the accusations got a little bit louder and a little more extreme, and at the same time, a little muddier. It wasn't quite clear what was abuse and what was just uncomfortable for people who had never been in jail before.
Monica Yant-Kinney and Tom Ginsberg of the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Tom Ginsberg and Monica Yant-Kinney. They reported on the political protests in Philadelphia earlier this month and are covering its legal aftermath. What is behind the protest tactic of not giving your name when you're arrested?
Well, they call it jail solidarity. And the idea is if you can't separate us, you can't play us against us. You can't get one of us to rat out the other. You can't really, if you can't separate us, you can't divide us. And we are all in one in body and in spirit. And therefore, we're not going to give you our names. We're not going to help you in any way. If we have to take off our clothes and lay our bodies limp in jail, we will make it as difficult as possible for you to keep us in custody or to pull us apart from each other. And the idea probably sounds really great when you're there on the protest line. But I think after a few days in jail, I think they at one point had more than almost 200 people, I think, had been Jane and John Doe's. And they a lot of them got some pretty high bail. And the idea was, well, if you can't pay that now, you're going to have to give up your names so that we can get a hearing to consider lowering your bail. And a lot of them held on for several days. But over the course of a weekend in jail in some pretty unpleasant circumstances, I think as of yesterday, they were gone. They were done. Now, a few of them did get out as Jane and John Doe's, with the idea being that they pay a little bit higher percentage because the city presumes that they're never going to see them again, and they will pay higher than what their fine would be because they're not going to come back for their hearing. But the protesters were real clear, and in fact, most of them kept their nicknames. They refused to give their names throughout the course of the events because they wanted to remain in this solidarity. And that was one of the reasons that folks who were criticizing their cause, saying, you know, look, you're claiming abuse or you're claiming mistreatment in jail, you're claiming that you've been targeted, but you're calling yourself Twinkle. That doesn't really lend a lot of credibility to your cause. We need to see more. We need to hear more. And very few of the protesters would really step up to the plate on that. They wanted to really stand behind the solidarity and keep those nicknames.
Several people were arrested at the protests in Philadelphia for the offense of using a telephone while walking down the street, talking on the telephone. Can you address the constitutional issues that have grown out of in the aftermath of the Philadelphia protests?
Well, there very well may be in one of the lawsuits that comes up a false arrest lawsuit. Talking on a cell phone is not illegal, obviously. However, if police can show that they were using the cell phone as part of an ongoing protest to organize it, to organize the violation of law, that may be a different issue. And legally, I think it's much muddier. One of the charges that a lot of them have been hit with is not just obstructing a highway, but conspiracy to obstruct a highway. And that conceivably could fall under that category. The ACLU, one of the ACLU lawyers, even admitted as much, even said as much, right after a lot of these people rounded up, that the targeting of people, which the police said they were doing, targeting of people with cell phones who they perceived to be as leaders or ringleaders, would, on the face of it, not necessarily be unconstitutional if it could be shown they were involved in mounting these. I don't know how that can be proven one way or the other. I guess we'll just have to see what happens if it will become down, maybe come down to testimony or witness testimony that one person was using the cell phone to do this or that. I don't know. I talked to one woman, another one who wouldn't give me her real name, who insisted she was talking to her mother. Who knows?
And interestingly enough, some of the protesters by the end of the week said they had changed their strategy. They were dressing up in sort of business dressy clothes so that they would not be perceived as protesters walking down the street using their telephones, but rather just businessmen, office workers, yeah, who were conducting their day's business. Clearly, they understood that the phones, the role the phones played, were a part of this. But the ACLU lawyers haven't filed anything with specific charges to violation of their constitutional rights, and in fact have more often been saying that the larger issue here is one of the trying to keep people from voicing their dissent, their right to speak out, that the way that the police handled this, the way the police planned it from the start, was an attempt to suppress their free speech. That may wind up being the issue that is the constitutional issue that comes out.
Yeah, I think you have to keep your eye on what the issue is. Certainly, people were involved in organizing and carrying out protests. But what were those protests? What destruction was planned? What disruption actually happened? And to what extent is the blocking of a road, for a few hours going to be a horrible thing that lands somebody in jail and requires preemptive arrests and crackdowns? And I don't know. I think that in the end, I think the police department here and in other cities and the city here will have to learn again, perhaps like was done in the 60s and 70s, how to countenance some level of protest and let it happen and understand that it doesn't always have to be a threat to the nationality or the autonomy of a state and a government. I mean, it can happen. I think Philly tried at certain levels to do that to a certain extent. On the other hand, they also had made a promise to the Republicans to make the city keep running. And they were really dedicated to doing that.
Monica Yent, Kenny, Tom Ginsburg, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Tom Ginsburg and Monica Yent, Kenny of the Philadelphia Inquirer.